sometimes behave so strangely. Hello and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast, the podcast on recent research in music and science. Today, we're looking at cognitive science and philosophy, a different piece of the music science puzzle than we've discussed before. And to get into that, I'm joined by Marius Kozak, assistant professor of music at Columbia University. And he's recommended a recent paper by Andreas Gavio, Dylan Vanderschiff, Silke Cruz-Weber, and Renee Timmers called When the Sound Becomes the Goal, 4E Cognition and Teleomusicality in Early Infancy. So, Marius, how's it going today?
It's going well. Thank you for having me here. I'm really excited to talk about this paper.
Yeah, it seems like a very interesting piece of trying to understand how musicality develops in humans, in each individual human, which is going to be fun to get into. Okay, so I'm going to try to give a summary of this, which is a little bit difficult for me because I usually talk about experiments, but here we go. So the premise of this paper seems to be to frame early musical behavior through the 4E approach to how cognition develops. So interpreting cognitive processes as embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended. So really bringing the idea of consciousness and the mind and development into the full body and the environment. And the key point, I think, that this paper is trying to make is to draw a distinction from proto-musicality, which is how people in development talk about behaviors that we see in infants that can be related to musical actions, like making sounds that infants make, how they move, it seems to be a little bit like music, to what he identifies as an attentional shift towards controlling and engaging the sound itself. And he calls this type of action teleomusicality. So the transition between what might be considered proto-musical to teleomusicality is a shift that can be recognized between 6 to 10 months of age in the infants, when it seems like they're actually engaging in sound-oriented behaviors for the sound itself. So there seems to be an attentive shift that makes the sound worth exploring in and of itself. And this then can be seen to generate all kinds of adaptations in sensory motor networks that would then tune towards musical behavior in a more direct and then in a more, I don't know if you could say rewarding, but it pushes towards a self-organized musical action behavior. That was pretty rough, Marius. Does that give a kind of a sense of what's going on here?
I think that's a pretty good summary. I agree that teleomusicality is the main point of this article and the distinction between teleo and proto-musicality. What makes this article interesting is that it's a more of a theoretical exploration, you know, a framework or maybe a hypothesis even, rather than a report on the author's own experiments. Mm-hmm. And I think it really, to classify it as philosophical, I think is quite appropriate in this case, because they do draw a lot on the philosophical literature. Mm-hmm. I think in general, the idea behind the 4E approach, that embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended approach, arises out of mid-20th century philosophical tradition. I would include in this both James Gibson as a kind of empirical forefather and the French phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty as a kind of more the philosophical forefather. And all through the development of this way of thinking, because we can't really think of it as a separate discipline because it's very interdisciplinary, and also it's not a single methodology, it's not a single theory. It's not a single even theoretical approach, but rather it's kind of an adherence to this principle that the human mind is not confined to a brain that interprets the world symbolically, but rather a human mind emerges from the interaction between the brain, the body, which in this case I wouldn't even separate, and the external environment. And what makes this article particularly interesting is that it treats music as a kind of behavior. And the authors are even I would say maybe audacious in proposing a general definition of music in early infancy, which is not anything having to do with particular acoustical aspects, but rather with the ongoing interaction between brain, body, and the environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we have this kind of theoretical development that's mostly based on, well, there is, it does connect with a lot of experimental work, but it also tries to draw conclusions out of thought experiments, and in particular out of observation of behavior. And that can be a challenge for recognizing potentially the importance or the validity of that kind of information gathering. How do you situate this kind of work with respect to more measurement-oriented and direct experimental sort of methods?
I think that, as you mentioned, this method draws on a lot of experimental literature and interprets the findings in light of the 4E framework. For me, and something that I want to ask Andrea about, is precisely how to operationalize mm-hmm. this hypothesis. Because on the one hand, music, of course, we all know, is a very complex phenomenon that is not only limited to just the acoustical properties of sound, but also includes behavior and society and culture and interactions between humans, between humans mm-hmm. and objects, between humans and sounds. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, it's sort of admirable that this approach does not flatten out the behavioral surface of music, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? It acknowledges the sort of the uniqueness of each individual interaction and the intricacies of these interactions and how they develop. But something that I hope, ask Andrea, what sorts of possibilities for empirical work does this work hold for
mm-hmm.
him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things that I found very satisfying about this was the focus on developmental stages. So not only does this look at how humans might develop sound involving interactions kind of as a consequence of other stuff, but really focus on stages at which we tend to become capable of different kinds of attention and different kinds of engagement as infants develop certain kinds of control over the body, which, you know, it takes a while.
Exactly. And I just wanted to add that one other really key aspect of this paper that resonated with me is how the distinction between the different kinds of music as behavior, what its implications are for music pedagogy mm-hmm. and musical understanding later on in one's life. And in particular, the idea that music is a sort of abstract achievement of this disembodied mind that can only be appreciated analytically, cerebrally. You know, many of us are probably familiar with the image of somebody seriously listening to music, you know, eyes closed, mm-hmm. preferably in a quiet place by themselves. And yet, this is not the kind of musical behavior that we observe sort of in the wild, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And even, you know, many of your listeners are music theorists and music analysts. Even for us, you know, we are thought to have this very abstract approach to music. And yet, when I do music analysis, and I'm sure it's the case for many others, I play around with the sounds. I sit at the keyboard or I mm-hmm. take out my violin and I play around with different sonic possibilities of a piece of music that I'm about to analyze. So I think that making this point is very important because many of us are prone to think about music appreciation as a disembodied activity of the mind. And yet to incorporate behavior opens up a whole new possibility for discovering different musical meanings.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, this approach is so focused on the interaction between perception and action. By focusing specifically on motor neurons as a means to develop a musical understanding and a musical behavior, they suggest in the paper that infants may not possess the motor knowledge required to specifically focus on music until they begin to engage in this. And so, you know, it brings up all kinds of questions of, well, what is the experience of music when there is no parallel for musical action? It's not to say that we can't extrapolate or, you know, as fully functioning adult humans, we're quite capable of understanding other people's actions, even though we haven't necessarily, you know, done those precise things ourselves. But what is that like for an infant? What is that like along the stages, the very gradual stages of understanding and control that that children have to go through in order to be able to, you know, reach a point of control that is comparable to the music that surrounds them. All right. How did you come across this paper?
My own work is from a much, much more philosophical perspective, concerns the way in which bodily interactions with musical sounds create different kinds of musical meanings or possibilities for different kinds of musical meanings. But, you know, I also do touch on this cognitive and perceptual literature quite a bit, kind of like Andrea here, drawing on it to come up with more theoretical frameworks. Andrea and I actually go back quite a few years. I would say maybe eight or nine. Mm-hmm. And I followed his work very closely, and we've had many conversations about precisely this idea that music is a sort of behavior, and that we have to take behavior itself into account when we talk about musical meaning. Mm-hmm. And in fact, this paper does come out of Andrea's PhD dissertation. I think that's mentioned in the acknowledgement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which suggests to me that he's going to have a lot more to say about this material.
I sure hope so.
Yes. All right. Let's bring him on then and get this larger conversation started. And now joining us on the line is Andrea Schiavio, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Graz.
Yes. Hi.
So we've just been giving the background on your paper. And now I really want to know, how did you end up studying this? Where did this project come from?
Well, thank you for the question. It comes from a number of different backgrounds, basically. But there are mainly two reasons behind this work. And the first one is that we were interested in exploring how 4E cognitive science could be used as a theoretical framework to capture certain aspects of early musical behaviors. So this is like a more theoretical interest that we have on recent development in cognitive science. And the second reason is that we were interested in a kind of a more concrete thing, that is, we wanted to differentiate two situations that are usually associated with the development of musical expertise in infancy. So we have vocal interactions with the caregiver, but also we have the acquisition of manual skills that infants kind of acquire while interacting with the environment in which they are embedded. And so we wanted to, let's say, define these two situations in a more precise way than usually it is. So basically, we found out that, at least in our opinion, there is no really a clear distinction between these two situations in terms of their functional role in acquiring musical skills. And also, there is a sort of tendency, for good reasons, to emphasize mother-infant interactions as the first musical experience after birth. And I say good reasons because, obviously, mother-infant interactions or vocalizations with a caregiver, they do display important musical properties and features, timbre, rhythm, pitch, and so forth. But as a result, the role of manual exploration, at least in the ontogenesis of music, remains a bit understudied. And so these are the two, let's say, two backgrounds that we wanted to put together.
How did you get involved in developmental work? What drew you to focusing on this early stages of musicality?
So I was always interested in the development of musical expertise and the acquisition of musical skills from infancy, mostly for biographical reasons. I've been, I used to be a classical musician with bad results. And so I was always interested in see how, you know, people could become very good musicians, starting even from infancy. And but also, besides this, there are other reasons. So I've always been exposed to a lot of empirical work in the in how perception and action are coupled, and there is some good literature about infants, and so my interest comes from these two directions, right? One on the one side from music, and on the other from more empirical work on action and action development or action understanding. And so since there's a good amount of good literature in that, I really liked the idea of putting these things together and emphasize the connections between humanities and sciences in this work.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us about the 4Es. Give your explanation of what this is really about and how important it is for research and cognition.
Yeah, So recent years have witnessed the development of this sort of new approach to understanding cognitive processes. And this is usually conceived of as four E's. So cognition is seen now as embodied, as embedded, as extended, and as inactive. And I think that this is a very interesting work, and people from very different disciplines also are involved in the further developing this research agenda. So when we say that cognition is embodied, this is like the most famous, I think, E of the four E's. So many people are now using the word embodiment or embodied cognition to emphasize the role of body in driving cognitive processes. And so the idea of cognition as embodied is that our mental life, so our cognitive processes, really depend constitutively on the brain-body system as a functional whole. So our mental life is not confined to the brain. The idea is that the body, our, I don't know, metabolic and emotional processes really participate in driving our cognitive processes. When it comes to cognition as embedded, there is a sense in which if we buy the story that cognition is not confined to the brain or to the skull, and we include the body, then we have to realize that the body itself does not act in a vacuum, but rather it acts in an ecology that makes sense and that allows us to do things. And so these kind of interactions with the environment need to be properly understood and put within the discussion of the mind, because of course, if the body constitutes the mind and the body is part of an environment, therefore the environment itself has to be part of this huge network of things that are unfolding at the same time that we could describe as the mind. And there is, of course, wonderful work here, both on embodied cognition and embedded cognition. One of my favorite examples is, the work by Dennis Profit and others on how we can perceive hills as steeper if we wear backpacks, and distances as greater when compared to a control group that stare at the same stimuli. So physical effort that determines the content of a perceptual state. And for embedded cognition, we have, so much work in the field now. One of my favorites is the book Radical Embodied Cognitive Science by Anthony Chimero, who kind of models these interactions between brain, body, and word with the tools of dynamic system theory. And just a few words about the extended E, the idea that sometimes some of the tools and resources of the environment can be functionally coupled to the organism itself. And the classic example would be computers or biological and non-biological memory. So we can offload part of our mind, in a sense, to computers to help store some information that it would be too difficult or too demanding for our biological complexity to keep. And so in being embodied, embedded, and extended, we can say that cognition is also inactive in the sense that we create our own experience through action, through our interaction with the environment, with our cultural and social environment. And we do that by imposing a meaning, by ascribing a meaning to the things that occur in front of ourselves, including music. So if we buy the idea of 4E cognition, we could say that organisms in general, living systems, do develop some sort of meaningful relationships with their environment. And of course, this is very different when you look at the biological complexity and the phenomenological complexity of the single living system. So for a unicellular organism, of course, what is meaningful probably is the nutrition, right? The organism looks for nutrition. But for more complex animals, for more complex creatures like human beings, there are many different kind of relationships that could be developed. And one of them, I think, is music. And music offers many possibilities for creative thought, creative action. And so this is where kind of I situate this study on the development of musicality, on this kind of framework that looks at cognitive processes as very holistic processes that are distributed across mind, across brain, body, and word.
So do you see this as a means of interpreting maybe direct experimentation, or do you see this leading to different types of experiments in music cognition work?
Well, that's very, very good question, because I think that it actually could be both. So on the one hand, this kind of work is inspired by a number of studies that look at the brain, but also at how the whole body resonates and responds to music. And it could also inspire new understanding for new designs in an empirical work. And at the moment, for example, I'm involved in some qualitative studies, so that we look specifically at certain features of a musical experience that could be referred to or could align with this kind of tenets of for recognition, but also more behavioral studies. So now I'm working on how people learn from each other without a teacher, how could people can learn music from each other without a teacher, just by communicating perhaps or enacting different motor repertoires that the other could imitate. And so there are, of course, certain certain experiments that are more useful than others, perhaps. But in general, I think that, yeah, both ways are could be really important for these. There's a growing amount of literature that investigates the activation of sensory motor networks during musically relevant tasks. I don't know, work by Haslinger, work by Altenmüller, and good reviews by D'Ausilio, Novembre, Keller, Hausen, and Knosche. So there is really a huge amount of work that looks at how certain parts of the brain can resonate to a specific musical stimuli when you have some sort of expertise that allows you to perform the very same action. So I think that this could be very relevant, particularly for the embodied dimension of for recognition.
Let's bring it back to some of the specific insights of this paper.
Yep.
One of the big challenges I see to study teleomusicality is recognizing the attentive shift, the distinction between proto-musical behavior and teleomusical behavior. How do you get at that? Do you have a sense of what opportunities there are for actually recognizing that difference in focus in infants?
So in general, it is quite recognized that between 6 and 10 months of age, infants could integrate different information concerning action and objects in like more sophisticated ways. But of course, it's a challenge to like individuate precisely when this happens and how it happens. And so, of course, we had to leave behind some aspects that could have been relevant to in this paper as well, like, for example, vocalization or how infants develop their own kind of creative musicality by vocalize and by doing sounds by themselves or by interacting with others. So we wanted to focus on a kind of a very precise feature of this manual exploration, that is the way in which they interact with objects to create sounds, because it's easier to individuate this kind of shift within across development. So, of course, this is a preliminary framework with a very preliminary taxonomy, but we really hope that in the future we could design some studies where the distinction can be drawn out more precisely.
One of the things that strikes me in this particular paper is how you try to integrate the more theoretical exploration with some of the work in the neurosciences, in particular work on mirror and canonical neurons. And for many, many listeners, probably they'll recognize mirror neurons as kind of like, you know, favorite object to love hate by perception and cognition people, in that they seem to be sort of the holy explanatory grail for a lot of this perception action coupling. And yet there are many problematic aspects in particular here having to do with the correlation between brain activation or neural activation and the idea of intention and understanding. So I was wondering if you can maybe explore that a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is one of the core of the problems, of course. I think that I agree with you. Mirror neurons have been used for many years to sort of explain everything. And so now, of course, it's understandable that some people may have developed some sort of general bad ideas about it. But I'd say that in current neuroscience, I think everyone would agree that human beings have neurons that are endowed with mirror-like properties. I mean, if you think about, there's a work by Iacoboni that, in which using a rare clinical opportunity, Iacoboni and his colleagues, they recorded single-cell activity in epileptic patients implanted for surgical evaluation. So this gives us like the definite proof, let's say, that there are some neurons like that in humans, so not only in monkeys, where single-cell activity was studied already. What I'd like to say is that, so even if there is agreement to certain points, at least, on the fact that there are neurons like that, the problem is about the interpretation. So, of course, there was this recent debate by Gregory Hickok and Vittorio Gallese. There was this talk recorded at NYU where they were discussing about the role of mirror neurons. And of course, the main problem was how you interpret the way in which they fire. And so many advocates of Fourier cognitive science tend to dismiss somehow the role of mirror neurons, in particular the role of embodied simulation, which is the mechanism that is supposed to allow us to resonate and sort of understand directly what another person is doing or feeling by simulating it with our cognitive system. So some people tend to not agree with this interpretation, saying that is very internalistic, that is very individualistic. But I tend to be more conservative here. And I think that this explanation has some benefits. And of course, the problem would be reducing cognition or our understanding of the other to neural firing. Of course, the relationship, as Marius was saying, the relationship between neural firing and experience is the biggest problem in in neuroscience for, I don't know, for many years, and probably will be still the main problem. So now we have correlational studies, and I think we should try to ask ourselves what is the meaning of those studies and how they could tell us something about music in our case or about other things. And so what we try to do here is to look at some evidence about how actions develop in infants and how these kind of neurons participate, for example, in action understanding and prediction, and try to make some connections with musical behaviors. So, for example, I mean, we know that there are some links between active production of sensory effects and the perception of these effects. And these have been found with behavioral and neurophysiological measurements across development. And similar effects of motor expertise have been found in adults. So we certainly have a large amount of evidence showing that there's a deep connection between our repertoire of action. So how we can act, we can do some motivated actions, and the way in which we perceive the world. So probably the mirror mechanism is part of this kind of mechanism, of this kind of this process. But probably we should be very careful, as Marius rightly told us, not to reduce perception, cognition, or action to only the working of this mechanism.
Right. Well, since you brought up vocalization before as something that you specifically didn't talk about in this paper, and that was the sense that I had, was that you were focused on behavior other than vocalization. And, but in this question of the role of understanding musical signals in the context of one's own experienced action, I mean, that does bring up this big question of, well, then what is an infant's experience of something like a lullaby? What are they working with if they have no context for that kind of behavior? What are they taking from that?
I think this is, of course, an open empirical but also theoretical question, right? Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, we could say that infants do have the motor expertise to produce certain kind of vocalization. So in a sense, they could resonate with the vocalization of the caregiver, perhaps. Mm. Okay, let's try to give an example here. So imagine we are watching something that we can't do. So, for example, a dog wagging its tail. Mm-hmm. So obviously, we don't have the direct experience of what this kind of phenomenon entails because we don't have a tail and we cannot wag it. Mm-hmm. But there is a sense in which we could still understand the perception, the phenomenon that we're witnessing. So probably there is a difference in the sense of how we can experience these two different phenomena. So one that we could do and produce actively and one that we cannot do that. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's the way to access this experience for a scientist, it's always a matter of problems, because of course we are dealing with first-hand experience, and for us we probably at the moment lack scientific tools to look at it in an objective way. And so I think it's still an open question to look at fine-grained experience and try to carve out really some good observation that could help us illuminate on this particular phenomenon even more.
I mean, I have trouble with this example of us thinking about a dog wagging its tail, because at least our interpretation of that action can be scaffolded on a highly developed structure of embodied action. You know, we can even imagine the sensation of tail wagging because we have an organization in how we understand the body already, our own body. Infants don't have that to begin with, you know, or at least that's a kind of common premise, is that infants don't start with a strong structure, organization of how their bodies move. That's something that they develop with practice over time. Yeah. So if they're starting without even that, are they then just kind of building something to just make sense of the sound structure? And then, you know, would that carry forward in how they understand music later? Or would that be something that gets entirely replaced as they come to understand, let's say, goal-oriented sound construction, sustained vocalization, you know, tuning and all of that stuff.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because that's really interesting, right? So, because on the one hand, we know that infants, when still they are in the womb, they have experience of sounds. So actually, when they come up in the world after birth, they already have some sort of experience of hearing and listening to sounds. So perhaps there is a sense in which they could put it into a context, or at least they could connect it with specific sensations and emotions or feelings, how you want to call them, that they were experiencing when they were in the womb. So in a sense, I understand what you're saying, and I understand why you have troubles also with the example of the dog. Even if so, the idea of putting into context is certainly different from the idea of knowing how to perform it. So this is the level of description that I was interested into in this paper. So to kind of see the thin line between the idea of perceiving something as I don't know, certain sounds that we don't know how to produce, and the experience of the perceptual experience of a sound that we know how to produce and we can master completely in a sensory motor, in a sensory motor meaningful way.
One of the things that strikes me about this paper is that right now you're presenting music from a kind of ethnocentric perspective, that music here involves sounds, right? But there are, you know, cultures around the world that don't distinguish between music and behavior at all, that do not have a separate category for just the sonic aspects and just the social or the movement aspects of it. Do you think that the idea of Thieler musicality would be specific to our Western conception of music? And the reason I'm asking is because you're considering social coordination as the kind of extra musical value that is added after the infant has developed the constituted teleomusical acts, right? But I wonder whether the opposite might also be worth exploring, whether the playing with sound is a consequence of the social aspect of musicking.
Yeah, Marius, I totally agree with you, actually, because if you look at how I define proto-musicality, I define it as the kind of enabling condition of musicality. So in a sense, it's exactly how you put it. The way in which we interact with our caregivers, the way in which our context offers us some opportunities to do music or to play with sounds, those kind of constraints or offerings or opportunities give us a possibility to do music in more sophisticated ways, including motivated action. And I want to say that, indeed, I think that the notion of telemusicality being strongly linked with the idea of motivated action and intention, really does not distinguish between sound and action, but rather consider sound and action, action and perception, as two faces of the same coin, let's say. We can hardly distinguish between the two. And so the idea is that, of course, during development, we explore the word, and by exploring the word, we kind of encounter the sound properties of the word. These give us the opportunity, these give the infants the opportunity to develop creatively their, I don't know, the way in which they can play with sound. So yeah, I do agree with you that our musicking should not be reduced to sounds and silences or to sonic properties, but rather to the entire process of perception and action. And which, of course, involves also the social. This is, again, something that I didn't really consider in the telemusical aspect, but only in the proto-musical aspect. But it's something that I should definitely do.
Mm-hmm. To bring up an anecdote, my son, when he was around the age that you're talking about here, between 6 and 10 months, all of a sudden started responding to certain kinds of music by moving. Mm-hmm. Spontaneously, even kind of doing proto-conducting, which he had never seen. As far as I know. And it seems to me that for him, at least at that point, this arrangement of sounds in a particular way was correlated with movement. Whether it's moving, it's being moved by me and his mother, or whether it's moving by himself or with other people. And so there we have playing with sound, but not with a sonic, not with an object that produces sound, but rather playing with sound in some kind of a more abstract way. Mm. What do you think about that?
Well, that's, again, this should fall, I mean, let's say from my framework, this should fall under the rubric of proto-musical behaviors. Mm. So the objects of his or her behavior are not musical in the sense that do not produce any more sounds. So their actions are not oriented towards producing sound. We could say that her actions are more oriented toward exploring his or her own body through movement, or exploring the possibilities of enjoyment of dancing, something like that, which of course are all very important features of musical behaviors as we know it, but perhaps do not constitute a fully developed musicality, because we could argue that for that we need a more kind of precisely oriented movement and action.
I also have a bit of trouble with that distinction. One way to draw a line between dancing behavior and sound generated behavior is that sound is a broadcast signal. People that are around you can hear the sound that you make. And so it is a projecting kind of action. Whereas dancing is only something that is sort of present to other people if they're looking at you. I mean, unless you're knocking things over or whatever. and so that distinction between the impacts of these two different types of actions is, I think, an important one for maybe drawing this line between teleomusicality and protomusicality, except that if we're looking for an attentive shift, I wonder if that still might be usefully there for certain kinds of gestural behavior. Thinking about dancing as an adult now, and maybe trying to extrapolate backwards, the kind of attention that I pay to my body when I'm dancing is very different from the kind of attention I pay to it when I'm walking, or when I'm using that action for a different kind of goal, right? Mm-hmm. There is a different relationship to the bodily control that comes from a kind of tuning and playing and engagement. Well, it is substantially different. And so for an infant, what would it mean for them to pay attention to their gestures for the purpose of dancing or wiggling, you know, but dancing compared to the type of maneuverings that they do when they're oriented towards some other kind of thing, like drawing attention to themselves or just trying to develop some kind of, you know, would there be a difference between the learning to control the body for just sort of general purposes versus trying to control the body for this engagement in their environment?
I mean, I think the difference would be the goal of the action, right? Mm-hmm. So in the first example, the goal of the action would be to explore their own body and how the body could be employed to do something like dancing or moving or gesturing. Mm. And but maybe we can have situations where the goal of a specific action is more directly related to a sonic opportunity to mm-hmm. be developed. Mm-hmm. And so obviously, I mean, every kind of distinctions of distinction at this level are always troublesome mm-hmm. because, of course, you cannot capture the complexity of the entire phenomenon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, maybe it can give us an opportunity to think about how actions and intentions could be devoted to sounds in certain ways. And perhaps, and this was also one of my original ideas, to look for implication in the music education and early music mm-hmm. education to create sonic environments that really offer sound possibilities for infants to develop their own motor control with more sonic opportunities.
I wonder about social engagement in music and how or when you think that might play a role in defining something as musical. When I tried to go through the process of understanding what you described in terms of maybe vocalization, what I saw was that there was no line between vocalization for speech and vocalization for music. So for things like dancing or for playing music together, there's a kind of sharedness of action with others that isn't part of your definition. Is there another stage that you're thinking of that would bring in the role of others that might be there, for example, in Marius's son waving around mm-hmm, to mm-hmm. two musical works? And, you know, how does that fit yep, into this yep, framework? Yep.
Okay. Okay. Let me start with the social aspect. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, we could say that in our view in this paper, we think that social aspect enable the development of more mm-hmm. musically motivated actions, mm-hmm. and this also has something to do with culture. Now, there is an excerpt from Lucy Green's work that has been reported in a book by Andreas Lehmann, in which she asks us to imagine a 6-month-old infant who is given a wooden spoon, mm-hmm. and she starts to bang it against the wall. And she mm-hmm. and Lucy Green asks us to think of the following two situations. Okay, imagine what happens in our classic Western families. The first thing we do when we see this kind of phenomenon is to take the wooden spoon and say, okay, you shouldn't do that, right? And try to stop it as soon as the infant starts banging against the wall. But she says, well, let's try to consider what can happen in another culture, perhaps in Africa. Okay, let's try to see what can happen. And she says, well, maybe the other family members would take other spoons and start joining in playing these kind of rhythmical patterns that the infants develops autonomously. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, you know, maybe we didn't develop this aspect, but of course it's part of it. So the idea mm-hmm. of being of generating autonomously certain musical patterns is not to be divided from the social aspect in mm-hmm. which, because of course, you know, cognition is also embedded mm-hmm. in our cultural practices. Therefore, the way in which our social and cultural norms allow us to act musically mm-hmm. clearly have a very important part in the flourishing of us as musical beings. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I wouldn't make this differentiation too strong. Actually, quite the contrary. I would like mm-hmm. to keep them very entwined. So the social and the autonomous aspect. And the other part of the question was, if I remember correctly, was about the difference between speech and vocalizations. Mm-hmm. And here also, it's very tricky to find like a definitive or distinctive distinction between the two.
Yes, so, fair, yeah.
But what I try to argue for in this paper, what we try to do in this paper is to ask our reader to look for the goals of this action. So on the one hand, perhaps when we have infant caregiver vocalization and, you know, gazing and all the kind of motheries and all the musical-like parameters that are enacted within this context, maybe we could argue that in certain cases, the goal of those actions are different from those that are more explicitly musical. So here, maybe, you know, the mother is trying to make the baby fall asleep, perhaps, or the infant is trying to, you know, to gain some effective communication. And I think that, you know, even if these kind of behaviors do have some strongly, some important musical parameters, maybe the way in which they are enacted have a different goal from more music-like behaviors. And so here I draw the distinction. So when an infant maybe tries to sing a song just for the sake of singing, that is exploring his or her own vocal possibilities by, I don't know, applying modifications to a given melody or to variations and rhythmical patterns. These, you know, the goal between exploring his own vocal possibilities and more music-like goals, here the distinction kind of is very difficult to to say. So
infant babbling is something that is hard to draw a line on. You know, I mean, it's definitely something that involves an attentional shift towards sound. But in terms of saying, well, is that for, you know, musical aspects or speech oriented aspects, that good luck to anyone trying to draw that line. In your description of teleomusical behavior, you talk about OTA and your CTA. What does the C stand for again?
So this is a sort of taxonomy that we try to develop, where we divide telemusical acts into original telemusical acts and more complex telemusical acts called constituted telemusical acts.
Yes.
So basically what we say is that, okay, when telemusicality starts to be developed, so when infants start to do some behaviors that could be associated with music-like goals, then we could individuate two different kind of actions. So actions that are not so much complex, that are kind of very spontaneous, so grasping or shaking certain objects that make sound, or more kind of more difficult actions that require the unification of different original actions. So, for example, you can shake, but you can also beat the object against the wall. So you can create more complex sounds. And so I think that the idea of developing musical skills has something to do also with the idea of developing the accuracy of the performative accuracy of certain actions.
Is there any role for this kind of conceptualization of behavior in adult musicians or students developing their musical performance? Is this something that's part of later stages in musical behavior?
I think, interestingly, there are some continuities between the way in which infants relate to musical sounds and to music behaviors in general and how adults relate to that. So in particular, adult musicians. And one of my interests now is to look at how adults and non-musicians acquire musical skills. And I do see that there are some continuities. But I think that an example of a of constituted telemusical acts would be to consider an action like playing a chord on the piano. So this action requires, of course, temporal coordination, sensibility of the fingers, wrist, arms, back, expressivity, and so on. However, a skilled pianist, I think that it does not integrate these categories one by one, but rather she would achieve the goal, so playing the chord in a certain way, through a fluid and non-reducible execution. And so, again, the primary focus of this action remains the musical sounds being produced and not the kinematics behind it. So in playing the chord, a professional pianist would not focus distinctively on the different features that would create that particular sound. And this, you know, can be applied to musical phrases, like do you focus on the different, on the single notes or or on the expressivity on the entire phrase. So certainly there are a lot of similarities, I think, in how we developed more complex actions from the very simple ones in music, like in very different areas. But of course, this is something that we should investigate with more accuracy in the future, definitely.
I had sort of a more general question about this paper, because I see that it's coming out of your PhD work. Okay, so I guess my question concerns the reception of this article. I know it's very recent, but I'm thinking in particular about the idea that the 4E approach is not a settled matter. And it's still quite controversial, despite the fact that it, you know, it's been around for some 60 years. And there are two sort of fronts of critique. And one is more philosophical and has to do with this questioning whether or not the environment and the body, in fact, constitute the mind, or mm-hmm. whether they're merely causal, whereas mental processes are confined to the brain. Mm-hmm. So that's one area of critique. And the other area of critique, I imagine, coming from more empirically oriented cognitive scientists, for whom this theory is difficult to operationalize. And, mm-hmm. you know, in my own reading of 4E literature, I find this to also be a problem. One example of a positive use of the 4E approach, I guess we can call it that, comes from the work by Andrew Wilson and Sabrina Galanda.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, their work is focused on more basic sorts of actions in which the symbolic content is not non-existent, practically, such as, you know, throwing and catching balls, whereas here you're talking about music, which is far more complex. So I was just wondering whether you can talk briefly about how people have perceived this, received this paper?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I got good comments generally, and I've been presenting these around in different contexts in both psychology and philosophy and music. And so generally, I think it depends on how you want to present your work. I think it's important to know that that this work, the work in 4E cognition in general, has some limitations, obviously, because of empirical work has not been fully developed, as you mentioned clearly. But in general, the reception is okay, in music at least, right? I'm saying we make some good connections with the work in music education. And so from here, we find a lot of similarities between the way of conceptualize cognition as continuous with certain basic life processes or biological processes, and the way in which the new ways in which music education has been treated in the last few years. So now there is much more focus on improvisation, on mm-hmm. on how we do not need to just, you know, listen passively to our teacher, but rather we should more kind of interact with the teacher. What I try to do, and what we have been trying to do, at least in the 4E community in music, is to kind of look forward to individuate sort of examples that are concretely based into musical practices, to find out or to explore how 4E cognitive science can capture maybe some other aspects that perhaps remain understudied when you look at the same phenomenon from a different perspective. And so connecting it with music education could be, I think, a good move if we want to reach a broader audience and if we want to look for also concrete implications in music and in music generally.
Andrea, do you have any last comments you want to share on this work?
No, I mean, I just want to say that I'm thankful to my co-authors. And even if, of course, this work started, originated in my PhD and even before in my master thesis, you know, I'm very grateful to my co-authors, René Timmers, Silke Kruse-Weber, and Dylan Vanderschiff, because they've been really helpful. And we kind of worked together on this paper. And I'm so thankful to you, Finn and Marius, for being so kind and hosting me here and giving me the opportunity to talk to you about this paper. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. This has been a very interesting discussion, and it's really great work. So I'm happy for the chance to share it.
And it's been my pleasure as well. And it's always nice to talk to you, Andrea, about our projects. And I look forward to what comes out of this in the future.
So that was a very interesting conversation. We got into a lot of different things there. Do you mind, Marius, trying to give a final summary of what this paper is really about?
Certainly, or at least what I take out of it. Mm-hmm. The paper tries to situate music within the cognitive approach called 4E, which, again, we've heard it several times, but again, it stands for embodied, embedded, enacted, and extended. And the authors develop a theoretical framework for thinking and understanding the behavior of infants and how musicality develops. I think what came out of the conversation in particular was that this has huge implications for how we think about music education, not only of children, but also later on of adults. And Andrea was very kind to expand beyond the framework of the paper to talk about more kind of cross-cultural aspects of it, mm-hmm. and not just thinking of music as having particular sonic characteristics, but also stemming from a particular kind of behavior. And this is behavior mm-hmm. that is captured by the author's notion of teleomusicality, which is behavior with the goal of producing different kinds of sounds and discovering what those sounds are like, mm-hmm. what their acoustical features are, as opposed to the developmentally earlier proto-musicality, which for the authors has more to do with interactions between infants and their caregivers for the purpose of establishing some sort of a common affective or attentional ground.
The opportunity for understanding musical behavior and the exploration of sound through the connection of action and perception, and having that loop towards then different kinds of understandings that come not just from trying to control the body, but also trying to control the consequence, the sound itself, and locating it in the certain developmental timeline, is a really interesting way of articulating how important that role is to enable musical behavior in particular.
Although this paper is about infant musicality, I think it has huge implications for how we think about musicality in general. And, you know, my own expertise is in the area of music analysis and music theory. This paper and others like it may seem like these really tiny shifts in how we think about music, but together they really form this wave that is starting to take over the fields of music cognition, music perception, and music theory, which is to think about music as behavior. And this has put huge implications for how we study music, how we analyze music, how we perform music, the kinds of aspects that music brings into our everyday lives, our social lives. It seems like just a theoretical work, but I think there's important points to take out of this and explore further empirically as well as theoretically.
I really wonder what other people working in music development would make of this lens. This paper is careful to include a lot of research that's existent. How would scientists in this area then take that perspective, and how might it inform their future work? I'm curious.
Yeah, and I think that one way in which this will become manifest is through taking music experiments out of the laboratory and into the wild, and developing close contacts between psychologists and ethnomusicologists, music theorists, musicologists, even people from other disciplines, because, you know, what we're getting out of this is that music is so complex that to study it in a single place with, you know, very limited kinds of parameters that just happen to be easily operationalized does not give us the full picture of the possibilities that music has for our cognitive and our social development.
And that's one of the reasons why learning to understand different ways of knowledge generation that come out of different disciplines and coming to understand and respect them, I think, is an exercise. And hopefully that's something that we can continue to encourage in healthy interdisciplinary dialogue. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Marius, for bringing this article to my attention and to our attention and participating in this recording.
And thank you, Finn, for inviting me and for allowing me to talk to Andrea about this and to explore both what's in the article as well as what possibilities lie outside of it.
Well, and thank you, listeners, for joining us today. And if you are a researcher in music science and you know of a recent article in your area that you'd like to recommend, please get in touch. You can find us on Twitter and on Facebook, or go directly to the blog at sostrangely.com and leave us a note on our contact page. And until next time, keep digging into the how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.